begin. Last week we discussed the subject of the Tchias HaMeisim, the resurrection of the dead, and it was inevitable that we would touch a little bit upon the issue of Olam Haba, the world to come, because there's a connection between the two. And the focus of it was on with regard to the concept of the resurrection. And I outlined two major positions, the position of the Rambam and the position of the Ramban. And tonight the focus is going to be specifically on the concept of Olam Haba, the world to come. And here too, this is a fundamental belief of Judaism, that there will be such a thing as the world to come. And here too, there is a major disagreement between the Rambam and the Ramban. And I want to focus more on that, and then sort of summarize and to try and formulate what I would call their eschatological scheme. Eschatology referring to the concepts that pertain to the end of days, the future, or the afterlife. So we're going to start off tonight with the idea of the world to come and the position of the Rambam, Maimonides. The Rambam outlines his position in a number of places. In the Mishneh Torah, you can read it yourself if you can read the Hebrew or you have English translations. This is found. Does anybody know where this would be found? What area? Mishneh Torah is the code. This is the first codification of Jewish law, and it covers every area of Jewish law. Mitzvot pertaining to our time today, and mitzvot don't pertain but will pertain in the future. The entire system of the Talmud. He went through the entire Talmud and codified, organized all of the laws so a person would be able to open it up and to know what the actual halacha is. So what would you say, in which area of the Mishneh Torah would you think the Rambam would talk about it? Okay, the answer is Hilchos Tshuva, the laws of Tshuva. So at first glance you may not understand what this has to do with repentance, but at the second glance you may get the idea. Because when you're studying about repentance, and basically, as we said, it's a return to God, so the Rambam brings down all the fundamental principles, because a person has to know what the stakes are. And that's a very important idea when you consider what kind of a life you want to live and what direction you want to go into. So the Rambam is making known all of the benefits of the Torah way of life. So in chapter 8, he goes into the issue of the ultimate reward. And the Torah speaks about reward and punishment. We read about it in the Shema, we read about it in the so-called Tochacha, the rebuke. If you read it, even on a simple level, you'll see that all of the promises, all of the rewards that the Torah speaks about if a person does the mitzvot, and all of the punishments refer to life in this world. And the Torah really does not speak at all, certainly not in a straightforward, literal way, about anything about a hereafter. Although there are allusions to it, but you wouldn't be able to figure out these allusions were it not for the oral law, which translates this and tells us that there's a deeper meaning. There's a reference. All of the ideas, essentially, about the world to come are derived from the oral law, from our tradition. God taught it to Moses, and Moses passed it down from generation to generation. After the fact, you can go back into the Torah, and you can see the allusions. But the amazing thing is that the Torah doesn't really talk about it openly. And as I explained the reason for it last week, the main focus, the major focus of the Torah is, and this is what is unique about Judaism, is how to perfect ourselves in this world. And the Torah realizes that people have very, very powerful emotions and very tremendous fears about their death and immortality. And they've devised all kinds of crazy ideas about paradise, some type of a paradise, which is totally distorted. And the Torah didn't want to take its claim on the basis of an afterlife. Nevertheless, it is a concept that we have to be familiar with, and even after I explain it, you'll see that it's only something that you can relate to. You need to know it, but you can't get too specific about it. And the Rambam says that the ultimate reward of the Torah for the righteous is not anything in this world. The system of reward and punishments in this world is not intended to be the ultimate reward for keeping of the Torah. That's to help a person. Because all of the physical blessings that God gives to a person, it's not because the physical is the good. And the Torah The Torah is just a means of obtaining material benefits. That's not the idea. The reason why God gives us material benefits and the reason why God withdraws them when a person's going in the wrong direction is to put us on the right course. It's not because we pray and if you do the mitzvot, so God will benefit you with wealth, let us say. It's not because wealth is the good. It's, as we've explained, wealth is necessary. A person is living correctly, so he has to deal with the problems of real life. And sometimes you're in a situation where it's difficult. You'd like to study more. You'd like to do more mitzvot, but you have a tough situation. So God will ease the path, so to speak. That's the blessing. It's only a blessing, by the way. We don't maintain that money per se is any kind of a blessing, because you see many cases where people become successful, and it's a curse. It distorts their whole perspective, and they get involved in all kinds of crazy things. So what was such a blessing? Any blessing that God gives us always depends upon how we use it. It's an important point to remember. People don't look at it that way. And people have this idea like a magical transformation, or a magical, there's no such thing. And even if a person were to become enormously wealthy, there's no guarantee that would be for the good. It's only if the person's living correctly. That's the best of blessings in this world, that God guides us along the path. That's providence. But that's not the ultimate reward. The ultimate reward, the Rambam says, is the life of the world to come. And the life of the world to come is something which you really can't form a picture of. Nobody can form a picture of it. The Rambam can't form a picture of it. And he says not even prophets. All the prophets that had access to things beyond the ordinary can, because God revealed certain things to them, even they knew about it, but they could not imagine. They could not form any kind of a picture of what that enjoyment would be like. So that already is a little bit of a difficulty. However, we know that it is the greatest possible situation to be in. Now, why is it that we can't paint a picture of it? If you were to go to a different place, somewhere in around the globe, and it was a wonderful country and a paradise, and I'd never seen it, but you could describe it. I could have some kind of a sense, because you're talking about things that are in my framework. The beautiful scenery and the beaches are totally different, but you can't imagine. I can imagine a little bit. I have a certain sense of what you're talking about. But the reason why you can't paint the picture over here, what is the reason why we can't really describe it? It doesn't lend itself to description. It's not physical. It's not physical. It doesn't partake of anything physical or psychological. It is the life of the soul. Now, this is a foundation that Adam, that the human being, has two components. There's the physical part, but the essence is the divine, the Tzelem Elokim, the divine image, which is not physical, which is something that that's of course created, because the only true existence is God. But when God created physical beings, but then there are higher, so to speak, beings. We call them souls or angels, which are not connected. They exist just like God is not physical. The ultimate existence is God, and God is not physical, and that is the element within us which has to be perfected. As I said, this world is a antechamber, is a prosdor, and that is the soul which perfects itself in accordance with wisdom, in accordance with separating itself from being steeped in the instinctual and directing itself towards gaining a closeness to the source of eternity, to God. When that individual dies, so it means to say there's no such thing as death, in a sense. There's no such thing as death. Death, that's why the Talmud says, the rabbis say, that the righteous, even in death, are considered alive. And the wicked, even when they're alive, are considered dead, because the true life is the life of the soul. And the law of nature, which says that everything which is matter has to be composed, that applies to the body. So, I can just describe. When a person, so to speak, dies physically, the soul has perfected itself, so that soul lives on. But that soul lives on in a completely different state. Olam Haba is a state of existence of the soul, and that's the ultimate reward. The reward, then there's no reward that's greater than that. And what does it consist of? It consists of two things. Eternity, eternal life. V'harachta yamim, length of days, as the rabbis say, la'olam shakulo arach, a world which is eternal. V'tovloch, and it will be good for you in a world which is completely good, which means that these are the only two things that we know about it, that the good that you'll experience in the world to come is categorically, qualitatively different than any good you could possibly experience in this world, because this is a a fundamental principle, not just of the rabbis, but all of the great philosophers, that the good that a person experiences, any enjoyment, any pleasure that a person experiences in this world, is not perfect pleasure. Because it's always fraught with a certain amount of pain. And we can't go into that right now, but whatever you think about, whatever you'll point to, every area of your life which you enjoy, but it's not perfect enjoyment, because there's always a certain amount of aggravation, there's always disappointment, there's always pain. So when you say it's good, you mean in your mind it's a trade-off. On balance, it's something which I consider positive. But it's not perfect. There's no such thing as perfect joy in this world due to the fact that we're physical. And that is the position of the Rambam, that man is destined for a different kind of an existence, which is eternal and perfectly good, because the source within us that detracts and that causes us all kinds of, the physical element in man, according to the Rambam, that's temporary, that God joined, so to speak, the soul to the body, that's the will of God, that we have free will. We're not going into why there's free will, that we just have to take that as a premise for tonight's purposes. But once the person has perfected himself in this world, and that's key, because not everybody has the world to come. Although it says all of Israel has a share in the world to come, but that doesn't mean it's by virtue of the fact that you're born a Jew. There's a concept of Israel, someone who's wicked. He's an Israelite and he's wicked. What constitutes a Jew for this purpose is someone who essentially, fundamentally, believes in the fundamental principles and is a good person. There's different degrees of Olam Haba. I'm going to return to that point, which is very crucial. And that's also, somebody asked me this question last week, could not understand the idea that there's a different, you can have a different portion. There's different degrees to which you have Olam Haba, the world to come. To them, and I would agree, that's the way, as a child, and that's the way everybody would imagine it, either you're in or you're out. I mean, it's paradise. Do you make it or don't you make it? But once you're in, we're all together, aren't we? No. But I'll have to explain that. That's another thing that's really unique. I don't think there's any other religion that has this concept, that there's a share. And to what degree do I have the world to come? That is the position of the Rambam, that is the ultimate reward that God has promised us for, and that's what the Torah is directing us toward. As I said, it's the best system for life in this world, but beyond that, it perfects the soul and renders it fit for the life of the world to come. The Rambam has a very interesting and very controversial position about the ultimate punishment. That's very, very controversial, and I'm not going to... I know you'll have a lot of questions on his concept. What is anybody familiar? What does the Rambam maintain is the ultimate punishment of the wicked? What happens to the wicked? Now, we've all been raised with the idea of Gehenna, of hellfire, eternal hellfire. That's what the Rambam says. He says that the ultimate punishment for the wicked is the loss of this life. Does not partake of the world to come. That's what he calls kares. The soul is cut off. Because that soul has not separated itself from the physical. That person is essentially like an animal. Because he didn't activate the divine element and was completely attached to the instinctual. So that person is essentially like an animal and will suffer the same fate. I know it's very controversial, because what's unique about it is that there's no... we want revenge. There's no revenge. Where's the revenge? Turns out that a person could have been a horrible individual, wicked. I don't even want to mention Hitler and people like that, and they're just going to lose the world, and that's it. We always imagine in the back of our minds that there's much more than that. That's sort of like easy. However, I'm just throwing that out. And the Ramban challenges the Ramban on that point. So this is a big debate. And as I said, on these types of issues, there's no psak. There's no decision that this is what you have to believe, this is what you have to believe. You just have to believe in the general idea, but the particular formulations, that you're free to choose. But you should choose not because it's more pleasing to you, as I say. You should choose because it makes more sense to you. And that's the position of the Rambam. Now, we just have to understand, what is the basis? What is the basis where the foundations of the position as far as the Rambam is concerned? And I would say that there are two foundations. First of all, you have the Rambam's entire philosophical outlook. And his whole attitude towards the life in this world. And of course, it's not an ascetic existence, but essentially, the true good, The true good, according to the Rambam, as we said, is the pleasures of the soul, which have to do with the perception of the Creator, of the wisdom of the Creator, and an attempt to draw close to the Creator. So his entire philosophical outlook, that the physical is simply a means to an end, and that the physical pleasures are not ends in themselves, lead him in this general direction. So that the ultimate good is, by the way, if you take a look at the Torah says about the Moshe Rabbeinu, that Moshe wanted to know God. Because Moshe pleaded with God, show me your glory. And the Rambam explains that he wanted to have a positive idea of God. And God said, Ki lo yirani ha adam v'chai, that a person cannot see me. See me means can't know me. That v'chai, as long as he's alive. Which means to say that to have a true and accurate concept of God himself is impossible due to the fact that the mind is connected to the physical and it can't attain that degree of abstraction. So the Rambam learns, what does the pasuk say? You can't see me, you can't know me insofar as you're alive physically. But when you're no longer alive physically, when you're separated from the physical is essentially something which holds you back. I know these ideas may sound a little bit strange because our whole orientation is basically towards the physical. And we look at the other part as holding us back. But that's not what that's not the way it is. You'll see that we have an inverted view. Our values are totally inverted. What we consider to be the good is not the good, and what we spurn, what we're not, you know, like we're forced into, well, that's the real good. We have to change our whole orientation over here. And but when you see reality like the Rambam sees it, that's exactly what it means. That ultimately the reward for man will be that he'll obtain a type of knowledge that he could not obtain due to the fact that he's connected to the physical. So the connection to the physical is not a great boon, is not a great good as far as the Rambam is concerned. And while, as I said, these ideas are strange because you're living in a society that doesn't live according to this, but we have to make an effort to begin to study more and to get a clearer understanding. These ideas do become clearer to you only with time, if you put yourself on a path of study and learning and knowledge, and you have to develop a certain appreciation of that. That's crucial. You must develop an ability to be involved in this world and an appreciation of the joy. When you have that, you'll be a totally transformed individual. There's one other thing, though, that the Rambam based himself on. It's very, very crucial in the whole debate. He says that in the world to come, there's no bodies, nothing physical, but just the souls of the righteous alone, without a body, as the ministering angels. And he says, since there is no body, there's no eating, there's no drinking, and none of the things that occur, none of the activities that we engage in because we're physical, and like sitting, or standing, or sleeping, or death, or depression, or laughter, and the like. It's a completely different kind of an existence. Now, there's a statement of the rabbis that he based himself on, and this is crucial in the debate. This is what the rabbi said. In the world to come, there is no eating, and there's no drinking, and there's no sexual relations, except the righteous. Now here they do employ certain physical terminology, but the righteous sit, well, sitting, that's physical. The righteous sit, and their crowns are on their heads, implies that they have heads and they have crowns, and they derive pleasure from the glory of the divine presence. That's the statement. This is the way he breaks it down. He says, it's very clear to you that if they're telling you that there's no eating and there's no drinking, so obviously there's no physical body there, because what would be the purpose of a physical body? Well, all of the physical instruments that we have, every part of the body is because of a necessity. In this existence, we have to eat and we have to sleep and reproduction and so forth. But once you've told me that these activities are not going to be present in the world to come, then it makes no sense to say that there'll be a physical body which is designed purely to engage in these physical activities, but it won't be engaging. To say that, he says, is to attribute to God something which is terrible, to say that God creates things that have no purpose. That is a very significant foundation. But it does say that the righteous sit. It does say that they have crowns on their head. So what does it mean? This is the Rambam's interpretation. That part is allegorical. It's therefore clear to you that there's no body, because there's no eating and there's no drinking. So what's the purpose of a body? Now that which they said that the righteous sit, they said that by way of allegory. That is to say, they have to employ a certain physical term. That is to say that the righteous exist there without any effort and without any toil. They sit. Sitting is just implying that idea, that they don't have to do anything to maintain their existence. Now, what's the crowns on their heads? What's the crowns on their heads? Anyone? Well, what's in order? You have to be more specific. They're being general. Yeah, we're trying to take... What? The crowns. Anybody? What were the crowns on their heads? And bear in mind, and they derive enjoyment from the radiance of the divine presence. And these are mystical terms. And I'm not mystical. So we've got to make it real. What? That's mystical. That's spiritual. Yeah. Okay, but all right. So but with that, that's a good point. That is a good point. And there's a good connection. Yes? The mitzvot. We're getting closer over there. The crowns, let me read from the Rambam. And that's interesting, the connection with Moshe, that, so to speak, there were rays coming out, beams from it, you know, his face was sort of lit up. He says like this, that the crowns on their heads is their knowledge, their learning. By knowledge, is, of course, Torah is knowledge. As we said this past Shabbos, that the idea of giving honor to the Rebbe is because he teaches you chachma, wisdom. So the gateway to heaven, as far as the Rambam is concerned, is based upon establishing this love of God, this relationship to God, which we have already learned can only be achieved through an appreciation of the chachma. Of course, then every mitzvah contains wisdom, and a person is supposed to internalize that wisdom. But the biggest mitzvah is Talmud Torah. And by Talmud Torah, it's not, I've explained already, our concept of knowledge is not amassing information. It's the knowledge, we recognize knowledge only insofar as it's transformed the personality. So the person has to be a righteous individual and a good person who lives in accordance with the true ideas. Someone who's wicked, the Gemara tells about people who were great, great Torah scholars, but they don't have a share in the world to come because it was all external. And they didn't internalize the knowledge. So whenever the Rambam talks about knowledge, he means that which has been internalized and perfected the soul. So they take with them that knowledge. That's the crown. The crown is the knowledge that they've achieved. See, that's what a crown is all about. That's the real dignity. That's the real majesty of an individual. Because of which they merited the world to come. That's with them. That they take with them. So in answer to the question, can you take it with you? With them. So it says their glory will not go after them. That's talking about those who amass wealth. That your wealth you can't take with you, but your real wealth you do take with you. The knowledge, and you can already see what I'm getting at about chelek. That is to say, if you, not everybody fulfills their potential. It's that knowledge, that appreciation of knowledge, is what determines, and then you have this pure joy. You have this pure joy. Which comes from the capacity to have an understanding and a knowledge of the Creator, a closeness. You see, they enjoy the radiance of that closeness to the Creator, which a person could not achieve in this world. And that is basically the Rambam's position. Again, he comes back and says the enjoyment. The essence of the world to come is this pleasure of the radiance of the Shekhinah, the divine presence, is that they know and they grasp something about the truth of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of the Creator, blessed be He, that which they did not know while they were connected to the body, to the physical. That is essentially, obviously in an abbreviated form, the idea of the world to come. It's immortality of the soul. And as a person, to what extent is a person can appreciate this and long for this? It's very difficult for a person to long for this kind of thing, because generally when you first start out, it doesn't make an impact upon you. It's not what you had in mind as a kid. Right? It's not. It's not. It's not a big turn on. But, and as you can see, all of the other religions have a paradise. endless pleasures, physical pleasures. But the Rambam talks about that, had the meaning of a thing like that, is he says that these pleasures are not, they're not so terrific even in this world. To imagine that this is what the Creator has eternally is an absurdity. Again, you have to, though, be mature about it. And the extent to which a person can relate to this idea depends upon the extent to which he can relate to the good. And I'm going to explain that more fully at the end when I make my summation. Now, the Rambam, another work which I recommend, very important, is the, maybe I should get a new copy myself, is the treatise on the resurrection of the dead, which I mentioned last week. And the Rambam, of all people, was accused of heresy. He was accused of denying the resurrection. Why was he accused of denying the resurrection? Because he speaks essentially about all about the world to come. But he does mention that whoever denies the resurrection is considered to be a heretic, that there is such a thing as the resurrection, but he doesn't devote that much space to it. So, for whatever reason, people misinterpreted his position, and they accused him of believing only in the world to come and not in the resurrection. So he wrote this treatise to make clear what his position is. And of course he provides us with more information. So this is in translated by Dr. Rosner. And here too he mentions that idea. He returns to this theme. See, for the Rambam, that statement that there's no eating and drinking is extremely significant. Once they've said that, there's no way that you can maintain that there will be physical bodies in the world to come. And he repeats that over here, and he says it would be false to assume that a person has these organs for no purpose. Heaven forbid! God would not create anything for naught. For if a person would have a mouth and a stomach and a liver and sex organs, would not eat nor drink nor procreate, then his existence would be absolutely for naught. And then he mentions that you might object, others have objected, but one second, the Torah says that Moses was with God for 40 days and 40 nights, and he did not, he didn't eat and he didn't drink. But nevertheless, you see that Moses had a physical form, and for 40 days and 40 nights, he didn't eat and didn't drink. Or the case of Elisha, that he went without food and drink for a long period of time. Similar situations. But he rejects that. He says that's not an argument, because that was just a temporary thing. Their organs were for a purpose. Before that event, they lived normal physical lives, and after that event, they lived normal physical lives. But to say that a person is going to be put into a situation where he has absolutely no use for these organs, and yet God would create them, is that he says these people are unaware of the enormity of the shame which devolves upon anyone who attributes to God an activity for naught and the creation of organs which have a purpose, but for no purpose. And he says that's exactly what we say about the idol worshippers. They have eyes but don't see. They have mouths but don't speak. That's idolatry. But when you're talking about God, to say that God would create something which is designed for a purpose in a situation where that purpose doesn't exist is an absurdity. And moreover, he says, whoever says that doesn't know what they're saying about God. And so he regards that as being a terrible thing. Also, the Rambam mentions the reason. The reason which got him into this problem is because the point is, and when you read this work, you'll get a sense of in what situations we interpret things in the Torah literally, and in what situation you have to interpret it allegorically. So the accusation basically was that the Rambam was interpreting all of the statements in the Tanakh, which relate to the resurrection. They said he was interpreting it allegorically, that it's not literal. So he discusses that a bit, and it's interesting in the case of the all the references to the days of the Messianic era. The prophets utilize expressions and they make statements which would indicate that there's going to be a change in the laws of nature. The famous statement that the wolf will dwell with the lamb and the lion shall eat straw. That is to say that the prophecy is that in the days of the Messiah, so there won't be any killing, there won't be any destruction, and Taken literally, the animals will dwell in peace with one another. All the animals of prey will stop preying on other animals. So, the Rambam says that these are to be understood allegorically. And he mentions that others have taken the same position. Although there are some, I believe, that take it actually literally. But the Rambam says that the wolf will dwell with the lamb, that there will be a change in the nature of the wolf. And all of the animal kingdom is now going to fall in love with peace. And there won't be any type of killing and destruction, even in the animal world. To take that literally, the Rambam does not agree. He says, and he explains why not. Because if you follow the statement, it says, they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord. Now, that statement itself is the giveaway. If you read that statement carefully, you'll understand why he doesn't take it literally. Why doesn't he take it literally? So, well, what's the reason that the statement is saying that the lion will dwell with the lamb? The lion won't attack. Because the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord. So that here the reason is given, that they will no longer destroy nor injure, because they shall know the Lord. This is the Rambam statement.
He's talking about a lion knowing the Lord or his lamb.
Yeah, right. In order to take this literally, you're going to have to assume that some change is going to occur, and now lions are going to be involved in the knowledge of God. So by telling you that, you have to read the Torah. You have to read it with chachma, with wisdom. And this is the language of the Rambam, who is my role model, and he's kind of blunt, so he says, can you, the congregation of Israel, find an intelligent person who would conceive a change in the lion, who during our own time devours and tears, and then repents, and knows what he needs to know of his Creator, and knows that he should not injure, and repent, and eat straw? Do you believe this? He's called the congregation of Israel. I mean, you're supposed to be the wise people that instruct mankind. This is the kind of views that you have? If so, the following scriptural phrase would be fulfilled, quote, and the vision of all this is become unto you as the words of a sealed book. So that is the position that Rambam is saying, yes, there are times when you take it literally. There are times when you take it allegorically, you have to be seichel, you have to know the context. It makes absolutely no sense to say that the lion will dwell with the lamb, or the wolf will dwell with the lamb, because the reason is given over there. The underlying reason for the peace that will exist in the days of the Messiah is because the world will be filled with the knowledge of God, and that knowledge will transform all people. Again, you see the road to perfection, the road to peace, has to be through knowledge of God. Every effort that's about world peace through all kinds of political means have a limited capacity. They'll never succeed. It's only when there's a fundamental change, but the change will be in human nature, in human values. And all of the mankind will discover what the real good of this existence is all about. So that's why he said, so what's it talking about? What does it mean then, but the words do say that the wolf will dwell with the lamb. So what does that mean? It's an allegory. The wolf is a reference to all the devouring, aggressive, sadistic nations that we have to contend with today. I don't have to name names, but you know who they are. And with the weak will dwell with the poor, with the mighty. The mighty will no longer destroy. Why? Because they will recognize that there's no good to be obtained in that. They'll all be transformed within pursuing of a new value. That's the idea of the allegory. But it's not to be taken literally. So he said, but then people, see, it's extremely important. This particular interpretation is very important to the Rambam, because the Rambam is maintaining that the Messianic era, there's not going to be any change in the laws of nature. Bear all this in mind. These are the parts. We're going to put the parts together. In the Messianic era, the Olam Kiminhago Noheg, the world goes in accordance with the natural laws. There'll be no change in the natural laws. There'll be a change in human values. There'll be a change in the societal law, but it will not be brought about by any change in the laws of nature, or even in human nature. That's crucial for the Rambam. However, he says, the statements that the prophets made with regard to the resurrection cannot be interpreted allegorically. Cannot. And he says there are some that are controversial. Some statements perhaps literal, perhaps not. But then there are those statements that can only be taken literally. For example, the one from Daniel, that's the classical one, which says that many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to reproaches and everlasting abhorrence. And the angel said to Daniel, as for you, go thy way till the end be, go your way in this life till the end, and then you'll rest at death, and shall stand up to your lot at the end of days. So the Rama maintains that these statements are absolute, and they're referring to this phenomenon of resurrection. According to the Rama, resurrection means the return. Very, very clearly states it, that it's talking about the return of the individual in a physical kind of a way. That is, the person who died will be restored and with the soul, and he'll come back into this world, and this will take place during the Messianic era. So now let us put all the pieces together and we formulate the Rambam's position. The Rambam's position has a beauty to it, has a logic to it. It makes sense. Not to say the Rambam doesn't. Our job is to elucidate. According to the Rambam, then, the purpose of life, which everybody agrees on, the purpose of life in this world is the perfection of the soul. And this is the only opportunity you get. This is the opportunity, and don't put it off, because 1 hour of repentance and good deeds in this world is better than the life of the world to come, which means that after death of this world, there's no possibility to perfect the soul anymore. So that's it. If you deserve the world to come, you get it, but you get to that level, that chair. If you don't deserve it, you don't get it. That's the end of the story, so to speak. The Messianic era is a historical phenomenon, which means to say that at a certain point in history, there'll be a perfection of the social order, which the life of man, which all these years has not been perfected because people are pursuing the wrong goals of domination and the material benefits, but that will change, and all of mankind will be organized for the true good, and then Israel will be restored to its position of supremacy. The world will recognize that Israel has the truth of God's revelation, and all of the world will come to the Jews to learn these truths. But that's the historical situation, which means to say that that's a situation in which it'll be much better to live in those days, because the entire world will be involved in this value, so whoever lives in that time will have a much, much better life. Not to mention the fact there won't be any wars. As we've mentioned on Shavuos, there'll be a tremendous abundance of the physical, so life will be 1,000 times easier, and all of the luxuries will be found with great ease, and it'll be a great time for a person to live in order to obtain the real good. Interestingly enough, the Rambam does not maintain that there's an end of days, that at a certain point in time the world won't exist anymore. The Rambam does not say that. The indications are from the Guides to the Perplexed that the world will be the physical world. It makes sense. It's God's will that there should be such a world. The difference being that at a certain point it'll be perfected and it'll go on. People will live in the Messianic era and they'll die, because the Messianic era is not the ultimate reward. What's the ultimate reward? The world to come. But you've noticed that the world to come does not mean in the future. This point was raised last week. Why is it called? That's another question they hurled at him. The world to come implies in the future. Now, according to the Rambam, is the world to come something which is going to happen in the future? No.
Well, for each of us, it's going to happen in the future.
Yes, exactly what he says. It's only called the world to come because you have Olam Hazeh, this world, and the next phase of existence. Relative to your faith, as soon as God created man, a body with a soul, the world to come was in existence. That is, Olam Hazeh means his existence in the physical form, and the existence which is to come is the, after you die, is the world to come. So Adam, he was in the world to come. It's not something which is hasn't happened yet. All of the righteous individuals are in the world to come already. For them, it's the world to come. Okay. Now, I just want to briefly go through the other position of the Ramban, and then we'll basically make some concluding remarks. If you noticed, the Rambam took great pains to mention that in the Messianic era, There's not going to be any change in the laws of nature. Not going to be any change. The world will function. There'll be a perfection of human life, but not because of the change in human nature or in the laws of nature. The Rambam has a very strong point on his side, and that is that statement of the rabbis. The statement of the rabbis is that in the world to come there'll be no eating and there'll be no drinking, and all that statement, and any logical person would admit that basically they're saying there's nothing physical. So how would the Ramban deal with that? Now the Ramban's position is that Ramban maintains that the Messianic era and the world to come is one and the same thing. So the Ramban maintains that right now there is no world to come. And the Ramban also maintains that the world to come is something which is going to exist in this world. It's something which is going to pertain to this world in the future, the Messianic era. So, and that's the resurrection. The resurrection, according to the Ramban, is that all the righteous individuals who deserve the world to come, when the time comes, Messianic era, they'll be brought back to life, and they'll be in the world to come. They'll be in that totally different kind of an existence which will come about in the world to come. So, there's a significant difference over there. So I want to elucidate the position of the Ramban to the best of my ability. And I think to understand the Ramban, the approach with the Ramban, you've got to go back to the story of creation and the sin of Adam. And that is, you see that Adam had a different kind of an existence than we have now. God created Adam and placed him in the Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. And in that existence, that was the highest level, the most perfected existence that man could have. And he would have been in that existence had he not sinned. That's the account of the Torah. As a result of the sin, he was cast out from the Garden of Eden. But apparently, the way the Ramban understands it, that the way God created him, and it says that God took him and he placed him in the Gan Eden, in the Garden of Eden, which means to say that it was the will of God, insofar as this creation is concerned, that there be a being which is unique, which partakes of physical, but whose essence is this non-physical element, the soul, and to live a certain kind of an existence. That existence in Gan Eden is basically his concept of the world to come, except that he had the capacity for sin. But his entire nature was such that he was completely involved in studying the wonders of the creation, in serving God. Now, what would have happened had he not sinned? Now, you know that God warned him, for on the day that you eat of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, you will die. What does that statement mean? The Ramban quotes the position of the rabbis. Had Adam not sinned, he would never have died, since the highest soul bestows life forever. And the will of God which is in him at the time of his formation would always cleave to him, and he would exist forever, as I have explained in the verse, and God saw that it was good. Now the Rambam's formulation is that man was created in such a way that even though he had a physical component, but the essence of man, it says that God blew into his nostrils the spirit of life, which means that he derives his sustenance from a higher source, from the will of God. If the will of God relates to his neshama, to his soul, so that's his basic source of existence. And therefore, prior to the sin, when he was on that level of living his life purely in accordance with the dictates of his neshama, of his soul, so that he would not have suffered death. Death was decreed as a result of the sin. And because as a result of the sin, his nature was changed. How has his nature changed? He became like we are. He became a creature who's involved in the instinctual. That is, we're drawn after the lust. We're drawn after the imagination. We're in conflict. We're creatures of conflict. God implanted the conscience within us, because that's when conscience was created. Without the conscience, we'd just be like any other animal, following our desires and using our minds to help us achieve it. That's the most dangerous kind of a creature. So that's what the way man exists now is in an imperfected state, and it's not. Although it's a human existence, again, you have the concept that man was subjected to a situation where he has to use his free will, he has to use his choice, and he has to engage in this, what we call the milchemas achayim, the war of life, to overcome temptation. And we're constantly challenged by temptation, by desire. And the rabbis say one should not rely, be complacent, believe in yourself until the day you die. Because that's just the nature of human existence. And you're climbing slowly and surely, you make some improvements, and then just when you feel like you're a tzaddik, boom, temptation strikes. In many forms. So you always have to be on guard, right? I think we've all had the experience. You have a good week or so, and then a slump. A religious slump. It happens to the best of them. But then you climb back. You go through, that's what tshuva. Why tshuva? Why repent? Why repentance? Because that's our nature. We always have to improve. And always have to be on guard. And that's basically life as we know it now, but that was not the intention. That's the result of the sin. This change, this fundamental change in human nature came about as a result of the sin. Now you understand why, when he was driven out of the Garden of Eden, so God blocked the path. From what? God blocked his path to return. God was afraid he might return and do something. Return to the garden and get there and snatch something. What? What was it? He might eat from the tree of life. The tree of life. God did not. The tree of life, the Ramban explains that. It's like the manna. That the fruits in the Garden of Eden were unique and were different, and they had this capacity to sustain life. And the tree of life was one which, if he had that food, anybody who wants to try and find it, you can make a killing. If you could discover the tree of life, because that's all people care about, is the fountain of youth, eternal life. So that's what the story means. That God did not want him, it would be very bad for him. If he had this fantasy of immortality, the knowledge that that our life is temporal, indeed, most people, that's not enough, because they just... I forget the author, anyone remember? The Denial of Death, very interesting book. No, it shows the extent to which people, in one way or another, are involved in the denial of death. And act as though they're going to be here forever, like this is just going to go on endlessly. That's not a good thing. Yom HaDin, Yom HaMisa, you have to have a certain awareness. It doesn't mean you should always walk around depressed. But you have to internalize that and take it into consideration that this is temporary. And everything you're struggling for, we discussed it with wealth, that people are building up empires and billions of dollars for something that they can never use, as though they're going to be here forever. Sounds crazy, but that's the whole world. So God did not want him to have this capacity to prolong physical life. So where do you see that in the future? The Rambam has a fascinating interpretation about the future when it talks about it in Nitzavim, in Devarim. It says that in referring to the end of days, referring to the Messianic era, it says something which does indicate that there will be a change in the laws of nature. It says the Lord God will circumcise your heart, the circumcision of the heart. That's something which makes absolutely no sense, taken literally. And the Ramban's interpretation of that is that there'll be a fundamental change in man. The circumcision of the heart means the subjugation of the instincts that now propel man and then cause him to be rebellious. And in those days, he'll return to the state that he was in prior to the sin. Because it has to be that way. That's the ultimate level of human existence. That's what God intended. So there's got to be a rectification of the sin. The sin of Adam will be rectified, and man will be restored to a state where he'll, by nature, the evil inclination will be destroyed, and by nature he'll desire, just like today he has a desire for all of the lusts and all of the instincts, then all of his desire will be to serve God, and he won't have any conflict anymore. He won't have any free will. That's right, he will not have any free will. He'll be in a natural state of serving God all the time. And I can't read the entire section. It is this which scripture says in the book of Jeremiah. Behold, the days come, says the Eternal, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel. and with the house of Judah. Now, I mean, other religions take it to mean that God is supplanting the Jews. I'll make a new covenant, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers, but this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Eternal. I will put my law, that is the Torah, I will put my Torah in their inward parts, and in their heart will I write it. That is to say, that the Torah will be inscribed on your heart. It'll be natural to you. It'll be something which you really have no choice over, something which you automatically love. And therefore, Jeremiah said, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall teach no more every man his neighbor, and every man his brother, saying, know the Eternal. They won't teach people to know God anymore. Why won't they teach people? For they will all know me, from the least of them unto the greatest of them. So the knowledge of God will be something which is part of your very nature, and therefore we want to teach people about that. This essentially is the Ramban's idea that in the days of the Mashiach there will be a change in the laws of nature. And what the Ramban really means to say is that there will be an end of days. That life as we know it, with the physical laws of nature, and most significantly with man as we know him now, will be transformed into a different kind of a being. He will be physical though. He'll be part of this world. Because apparently he maintains that that's the will of God. That's the definition of Adam. Adam is a being, well, that doesn't change. Adam is a being who God wanted. God wanted to create the hierarchy. God wanted the angels, created angels. God wants there to be one being that represents this concept. He's physical, he's instinctual, and yet the primary principle is the divine soul. That's the Garden of Eden. And that's eternal. Had he not sinned, he'd be eternal. But there's only one difference. In that situation, you have the capacity for sin. In the new situation, everything will be the same, but he will not have the capacity for sin because free will be taken away. So to all intents and purposes, he'll be living his life like an angel. And he'll be removed from there. He has no problem with what the rabbis say. There won't be any eating, there won't be any drinking, because he'll derive his sustenance and his capacity for life will come from God infusing the principle of life, God relating to his neshama, to his soul. So that's his basic position. That's why for him, the resurrection is everything. For the Rambam, the resurrection is not everything. The resurrection for the Rambam exists for two possible reasons. The resurrection is something which pertains to the Messianic era. In that era, there's going to be a change and there'll be a teaching. The teachers will publish the ideas of God and Torah throughout the world. So some people will be resurrected because of their greatness, like perhaps Moses, we don't know who. But it won't be necessarily as a reward. We also said that the resurrection also will be for some people who really deserved an opportunity to improve, to get a greater level of perfection for the world to come, but due to circumstances, the laws of nature, bad things, mishaps may have occurred. So there's this opportunity to come back. But the opportunity to come back, you see, it's only a good to come back because it provides people with the opportunity to enhance. Because you can't perfect your soul except in this world. So they may have achieved a certain level in their first life, and they were really deserving of a greater chance, but because of the laws of nature, certain disease, whatever it was, they couldn't do it. So maybe they'll be brought back as well. But they'll live a long life in the days of the Messiah, and everybody living in the days of the Messiah, according to the Rambam, will die. And then achieve their ultimate good, which is always for the Rambam, in the world to come, which is the immortality of the soul. So these are the two positions. And it boils down to, I guess, this fundamental question that it revolves around. That the ultimate reward which God has promised to the righteous, will it take place? Are we referring to the life of the soul separated from the body? And this is the ultimate state? Or no? It is a perfected state of human existence. It's human existence, but human existence in a state which is totally different than we are in right now, and which was the case with Adam, which was the will of God, and which will be restored in the future. Those are the two positions, and I want to make it clear that with regard to which one you adopt, you don't have to adopt either position, to be honest. And I can't say, it's not for me to say which one I think is correct. You have to be on the level. You have to be on a very high level of the Rambam or the Ramban to really get in there and say, well, I'm convinced that the Rambam is correct, unless you could show why. I would say that as far as I'm concerned, they both are brilliant formulations. They both make a great deal of sense. And you're free, as far as that is concerned, there's no need to make a decision, really, because that's not the important thing. The important thing is not to make a decision, it's to be aware. What the Judaism requires is that you believe in the concept, that there will be a resurrection, the concept, that there is a world to come, that there's an ultimate reward. But I want to point out two things in closing, two important points. The question was raised, what do you mean there's a different share in the world to come? That's troubling to people. And every other religion, you're in or you're out. I earned it, I'm there. How does this work? The best way that I can explain it is, and this is why it's so crucial, very practically important point to grasp this. The person that asked me was, I used the example of medicine. I said, let us say that the ultimate good is medicine. Or let us say the ultimate good is physics. Let's assume, whatever the case may be, you can formulate your own ultimate good. That's what heaven is. Baseball. I'm not going to say that. But let's say it's physics. And knowledge of physics is the good. That's what you were created for. To know physics, that's the greatest thing. But you're limited. I placed you in a situation where the amount of physics that you can understand is very limited because of the situation that you're in and the instruments that you have. But if you merit it, you're going to be transported to a different existence where things are just going to open up for you that you could never perceive over here. But it's going to be physics. So doesn't it stand to reason that a person that studied physics and gained a certain level of knowledge, but, had other things to do and didn't... So their appreciation and that's it. You've determined your level. They will not be able to relate to that good, that universe. Let's say we're going to the big physics fair. We're all going. Only people that achieve a certain grade, a certain level. So we're going and Einstein's going. Well, Einstein's going to get a lot more out of it than we are. Does that make sense? Now, if you valued it, if I told this to you, that we're all going to the big physics fair, and we've got a year to prepare, and you really understood how important it is, because that's the ultimate existence, and it's never going to stop, so I assume you'd all run to the library and start studying physics. Well, that's the idea over here. There's a reality. The world to come is a good. The good of this type of a knowledge, the appreciation of God, which comes about through chachma, through the knowledge. The good that you're going to experience in all of Abba is a good which you can experience now. That's the whole point. That is to say that in this world, to the extent that you recognize that good and partake of that good, to that extent you change your soul, and when you die, what do you think? It's going to be something totally different? That doesn't make any sense. This is perfectly logical that God put you in this environment and wanted, but because of choice, you're challenged. You're challenged by your illusions. There's illusions, there's temptations tempting you into the bad. Not really bad if it's a necessary thing, but it's not the way you look at it. That's the whole problem. We live with inverted values. That which is not a good because it's fantasy. A person makes any physical pleasure and fantasizes it, and then when either doesn't achieve it and is upset and disappointed or achieves it, and then is disillusioned because it wasn't what they imagined it to be. It's always disappointment because it's simply you've magnified it in your own mind. It's all in the imagination. And the real good goes unnoticed. The real good, as we say before blow the shofar, Sasa Nochel Limasecha, I rejoice over your words, Kamote Shalom Rav. It's like someone who discovers great booty, something, unanticipated pleasure. It's the unanticipated, but that is the real good. And the tragedy is the extent to which we're completely steeped in this inversion of values, pursuing emptiness, vanity of vanities, it's a tether, emptiness, and ignoring the good. But that's the deal. That's the deal. You've got to get a appreciation of what the good is, and the only way you could do so is to really work on yourself. You've got to change your whole attitude, essentially. In terms of being passive about it, you've got to really activate yourself and get involved. and learn and study, and you study more and grow it. And as you grow and as you begin to see things and to appreciate the chachma, your attitude will change. It's a long struggle, but the tzaddikim recognize this. They have a taste. That's the idea of me'ein olam haba. It's like a glimpse. You'll never get what. No one knows what it's like because we're all psychological beings. It's all through the filter of our emotions, and that's where the situation where you don't have the emotions. But the good that you'll experience there is the same good you experience here, except you're going to experience it in a completely different way. So now you got to get going now. Everybody agrees with this. Everybody agrees. That's why I'm saying, and my final point is that the argument between the Rambam and the Ramban is not that big an argument. They agree on all the essentials. That is to say that the ultimate reward, the world to come, whether it's here, whether it's there, is a completely different kind of an existence. It's an existence where a person is completely steeped, completely involved in that which is the greatest good and that which is the greatest pleasure. So the particularities are not that important. It's important to study them and to understand them as part of Torah. But bottom line, they don't have a different system. Like one is saying, paradise is this kind of thing, and one is has a different view of paradise. That's not, they all have the same view of paradise. That is to say, the Ramban makes this point, we're all saying the same thing. That statement is true, that the righteous sit in a state of tremendous ease and comfort and no distraction, and the good that they derive is that they benefit, they get this greatest enjoyment from the closeness, the radiance of the divine presence. So that's basically the exposition of the positions. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. Bearing in mind that I can't really describe much. Yes, go ahead. Yes.
How do you take on time with an event that the resurrection even though it's only applied to a few, but still it's the way we understand it against the laws of nature?
That's true. The resurrection, as we said last week, is a miraculous phenomenon. It's based upon that's not natural. To the contrary, the Torah has many statements to the effect that when a person goes to the grave, he doesn't come back. That's natural. But if a person denies the resurrection, he's denying that God created the world from nothing. It's like any other miracle. Okay, are there any other questions? Yes. Because I mentioned that if you came back this week, I'd answer your question last week, so. The Olam HaNefashot, the world of the souls, again, they both agree that when a person dies, his soul is alive. The Rambam would agree. But that's not Olam Haba. The Rambam, that's Olam Haba. Whenever you have a situation where the soul exists, separate from the body, that's Olam Haba. Interesting, though, according to the Rambam, you have the possibility that the person's share of the world to come can be changed through the mechanism of resurrection. That is, let's say the person was a good person, merited the world to come, and so when he died, he's in the world to come. But let's say God decided to bring him back. So now when he's back, he can continue to perfect the soul and reach a higher degree, so that when he dies the second time, he could be in a different level. That possibility exists according to the Rambam. That the level that a person occupies in the world to come, before resurrection, if that person is resurrected, he can merit, he can improve and perfect the soul, and then when he dies, can achieve a much higher level of life in the world to come. And I suggest that might be one of the rewards of the resurrection. That the person deserves an opportunity to increase a share in the world to come. Because all change in the soul can only occur in this world. Yes. For sure. According to the Rambam people, that's the whole idea of Yimot HaMashiach. Well, I would say, but perhaps that's the Ramban. Because the Ramban maintains that Yimot HaMashiach is Olam Haba. And Olam Haba, you got to perfect yourself now and you'll reap the benefits. It's like a bank account, what you take in Olam Haba is that which you deposited in Olam Hazeh, so to speak. That's it. You can't increase your account if you want to look at it that way. So it follows everything we said. Yes?
Well, then, specifically, in a bond position, someone dies, goes to Olam Haba, and then gets a second chance to perfect itself.
Rambam?
Yes.
Yeah.
High level. But the thing is, once it died and went to Olam Haba, it sounded good, then of course once it comes back to the death making, I mean, there's no free will either, because... Of course it's
going to... Well, the whole situation... Well, no, the Rambam, that's a good point. The free will, according to the Rambam, in Yelos HaMashiach. That's a good discussion. It calls for a more serious discussion. But just briefly, the Rambam doesn't say that there won't be free will. There will be free will, but the situation will be set up in such a way that people will gravitate. It will be like as if there is no free will. That is to say, imagine you had a certain type of a life. You were raised in a certain way, and you were surrounded by great, all your role models, and the whole world was involved in doing the good, so you would do it too.
Could be less via Tirhara?
Yes, to the extent that we were affected by the society, and let's face it, if we live in a society of perfect people, we wouldn't be doing all kinds of crazy things. That's the way we'd be as well. So you'd have the potential. You'd have the potential since you have free will. But the perfection of the Messianic era has to do with the whole system. How the world and societies will be set up in such a way that, you find certain communities, certain societies that nobody even thinks of doing anything different. Yeah.
And that's something that Rambam said, that things that the Nabi'im said were not necessarily things that will happen, but things that in principle could happen or appreciate you.
Yeah.
Now, both he and the Rambam sort of choose, from the Nabi'im, because in that survival said there is no. So, do they have any? What is the guiding principle? Which of the words we choose of things that will happen, and we have to support those theories, and which no?
Again, the Rambam says with regard to the words of the prophets. The words of the prophets were generally speaking were vague. That's why he says you can't map out the Messianic era. I mentioned this on Shavuos night. That nobody can work out from the words of the prophets how it's going to unfold, the Messianic era, for example. It's only after it happens, then you'll look back and you'll understand what they were referring to. It's kind of a roadmap in retrospect, but not in prospect. And that's where, as far as the resurrection is concerned, they just mention the fact that it will happen. But the particulars they have not revealed. Either they didn't have the knowledge, either the prophets did not have that specific knowledge, or it was better not to reveal it, just to reveal it so that we know the idea, but the particularities are vague. Yes, Avi?
The value objective of some people to be buried in Israel connected specifically to the one.
The question of being buried in Israel, as far as this is concerned, to the best, the Rambam does speak about burial in Israel, and you probably would more associate it with the position of the Ramban. Yeah, well, I don't think there's any direct connection. There is a value in being buried in Israel. The Rambam speaks about it, but it has nothing to do with this. The idea that somehow or other, that people mention that it's easy for the bones to that is mentioned, that to transmit themselves somehow to Israel, that's mentioned in the case, Rashi brings that actually, in the case of Yaakov, that Yaakov requested, don't bury me here, but bring me back and bury me in the Machpelah. One of the reasons mentioned is because of the difficulty of the bones. That's something which I don't understand, and I don't think was intended literally. The basic reason, Yaakov wanted to be buried not in Egypt, and he wanted to be part of the Maros HaMachpelah, is because of the importance of the Maros HaMachpelah, that this is the land which we merit because of the Avos, the patriarchs and the matriarchs lived here. So that's the whole value of the Maros HaMachpelah. And there's a value of every Jew should associate himself with this is his place. This is, so even if he couldn't live there, he's buried there. But I don't think it has to do with the resurrection, per se. I can't understand that concept of bones being... obviously, the resurrection will be a miraculous phenomenon. So it's not any more difficult for God to transport you or your bones, and cause you to be resurrected in one place or another locale. And if somebody maintains that there is, he has a concept which I don't understand. Okay. All right, I think we'll stop here. And the lesson we learn The lesson we learn from all this is, this is the 3 weeks, I can't close this without a little bit of mussar. And the whole idea of the 3 weeks, and the whole idea of the exile, and the destruction is because, unfortunately and tragically, the Jewish people who were given the greatest good were singled out for this tremendous blessing, did not even really see it as a blessing. And they tried to extricate themselves from this great blessing. And when this exile, the Rambam says, will come to an end when the Jews return to Torah and they do tshuva. And then they become the Jewish people again, who exemplify for all of mankind this profound way of life. So here we see it. We see the values, we see the benefits. The benefits are not the only the afterlife, it's the best way of life in this world. The transformation of values. That's what a person has to really work on. So he reaches the point where he not just, I can hear it, but he actually can feel it. Okay, well, we'll conclude here with that.